This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com as well. Coming up on this Monday edition, lots of interesting stories to look at, including some good news, at least for now, for the U.S. economy. U.S. companies are posting pretty good growth. Also, a really interesting story Grant has for us, how acting like a feminist can ruin your marriage. That's a write-up by a woman. And also the 100th anniversary of the Battle of Passchendaele. That and more this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio. We're at 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And thanks for joining us here on this Monday edition. A little bit chilly here today. For last day of July, we're only going to get up to the mid-80s, which is tremendous. I'm loving it. Abraham, you're liking it. Grant's angry, fuming. he says it's July, I want 110 degrees.
At least, if not 120.
At least, yeah. But so I don't know. I like it. I like a little bit of a break. It's supposed to be like that all week, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, Grant's fuming so much he's creating his own miniature climate around him. But yeah, it's refreshing after having pretty high temperatures for a couple weeks. It's nice to step outside. You don't feel your skin cooking on your body. It's just nice and refreshing breeze. So
we were talking about that yesterday. My wife and I, we were in town doing some errands, running around. And it is warm. I mean, it was warm. It's still summertime, so you're warm. But I said, you know, I think once it gets beyond mid-90s, for me anyway, my body doesn't know what to do with it. Like, it stops registering that it's hot, and I just sort of kind of become this very wet, oozing mass of humanity. But, like, I can't feel it after a certain point. So for me, like, 85 doesn't necessarily feel... Or, you know, 95 doesn't necessarily feel hotter than 85. It's just, I think my body reacts differently to it. Like,
see,
I just, yeah.
You're making my point. You become numb to it. You don't even notice it anymore.
You don't even notice it. That's why it's like when it's very hot in the summer, maybe a lot of listeners have experienced this. You get into your car, which is going to be quite a bit warmer even than outside, and you're driving home, and the first 2 or 3 minutes, like, I'm not sweating, but I know that this is very, very hot. Like, my body hasn't caught up to what's happening, and then you start sweating. But it's like you can't react to it fast enough. Your body's stunned by the heat.
Yeah, it is odd, and it always gives me false hope, and I fall for it every single time. I'd be like, oh, yeah, I'm going to get home. I'm not going to sweat. Like, I'll be able to – I don't have to take a shower or whatever. And because I don't have AC in my truck. But, like, about 3 minutes in, I start pouring sweat and have to roll down all the windows and – throw a leg and an arm out the window to try to get cool, and it's just I'm just throwing an arm out. I'm just kidding.
Sure.
But yeah, it's false hope.
I have seen people drive with their arm and leg out the window.
It is possible.
Yeah.
I saw it in where did I see it? It was in Fort Worth, Texas. Middle of a traffic jam. Guy comes flying onto the interstate off of an on ramp, cuts somebody off, and he has his left arm and left leg hanging out the window. And then he has the nerve to start honking and yelling at everybody else. And I just thought, wow.
In high school, one of my friends, I stopped accepting rides from him very shortly after this, but he was driving with his knees. Lots of people do this, but he's driving with his knees. He reclined his chair back, and he was just lounging while he was driving.
Yeah.
And like, fiddling around with his phone and stuff, and I was like, you probably shouldn't be doing that.
I'm uncomfortable with the person that's driving, and they're talking to you, and they have to look at you, and I can sense it, and so I know they won't stop till I look at them, so I look over.
And they have to make hand gestures, too.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, there was one time I was driving with this fellow, real great guy, but he was going too fast. He was speeding. And all the while explaining to me why he didn't believe in the rules of speed for the road. Like, well, you know, I remember the exact conversation as I was nervously watching the speedometer. And he was saying, well, you know, the interstate can handle it. and the vehicles can handle it, there's no reason we shouldn't be able to go as fast as we want. While we were going as fast as he wanted, so I didn't disagree with him. I just said, uh-huh, yeah. And he was a looker, too. He was looking at me. But I survived it somehow. He had all of his limbs inside the vehicle. So that was a good thing. Here's an interesting note. This is just a little blurb from Time Magazine here. Of course, we all remember the shooting of the congressman, Scalise. That was, what was that, a couple weeks ago, a month ago?
Back in June.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like it's been a while. But so far this year, there have been 950 threats to members of Congress investigated by the U.S. Capitol Police. Just in the first half of 2017, more than all such investigations made throughout 2016. I think that's got anything to do with network news or cable news? Some of the opinion pieces or some of the write-ups, you think that's got anything to do with it?
Again, if people are told constantly that a certain party or a certain group of people is a gigantic threat to everyone's safety and well-being in the nation, obviously people are going to respond to that and think that they are an evil enemy that needs to be eliminated.
There's a lot of people that are, what would you call them? Not the stablest individuals in society. And some are more prone to believe and act on emotion and opinion and not on fact or common sense. And so whenever people are talking from those big platforms or writing from those big platforms, you don't know who's going to read or watch and maybe take somebody at their word. And I think maybe that's what we're seeing more of.
Yeah, I think it's, I think as someone put it, that if people are already unstable and they have popular media justifying what they think or playing into their fears or whatever they might be, it just makes it all the easier to justify those kinds of illegal types of thinking. And I mean, with that 950 the first half of the year, that's about 6 to 7 a day threats made against members of Congress. So, I mean, that's a lot. And I'm sure a lot of them are big talk, but at the same time, it is disheartening in democracy when your elected officials are threatened that much.
Well, think back to, if I'm remembering correctly, Orson Welles, right? He did War of the Worlds on the radio.
Yes.
And people thought it was real. And people started going crazy. They thought aliens were invading. And that's kind of a classic case of people believing something that's clearly fictitious, even though during the show, I think they did say, like, this is, you know, a program or whatever. But people didn't know, and they got scared. Now, that's a pretty extreme example. But I think it highlights the fact that people can be very easily influenced, even by complete fiction, if they think it's true, if they believe it. And we've seen the same thing, I think, play out with these threats and that type of mentality against, well, whether it be congressmen or whoever.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great example. Just how, if you're not careful, you can let your imagination run away from rational thought. And especially last few years, we've seen how emotions have replaced logic in how people think about politics or form opinions or decide what to say. And so when you let your emotions take over, it's and if you're not in control of them, it's easy to get into things you probably regret later because you're in a frenzy. Or, I mean, we all say things in fits of emotion that we think later, like, well, I probably shouldn't have said or done that. But with these bigger issues, sometimes you make such a big mistake, you can't take it back.
Yeah. So anyway, it's a volatile climate. Here's some temporary good news anyway. It's from the Wall Street Journal about U.S. companies. U.S. companies post profit growth not seen in 6 years. What happened in the last 6 years? Oh, yeah. strong earnings come as tax and infrastructure initiatives that were expected to spur economy have been sidetracked amid Washington infighting. So even though they're not getting the plans rolling that they want to, they're still seeing growth in these companies. America's largest companies are on pace to post two consecutive quarters of double-digit profit growth for the first time since 2011, helped by years of cost-cutting, a weaker dollar, and stronger consumer spending. Earnings at S&P 500 companies are expected to rise 11% in the second quarter, according to data from Thomson Reuters, following a 15% increase in the first quarter. Close to 60% of the firms in the index have reported second quarter results so far. You don't hear a lot about that in the news, but that is some good news.
Yeah, actually, it coincides with some. I just finished reading a book about monetary policy because I don't know much about it. And a lot of the points they made is how much the economy, especially foreign investors or people who invest in big companies and American trade, how much it rests on American security, basically on the policies, security policies, the military, all that sort of thing. If people are confident that the U.S. is confident in protecting everyone, people put more money into the U.S. economy. When it looks like it's getting weaker, they pull their money out and start investing in different other countries or other currencies. And so I think there's a much stronger Tyler than we normally think of. But I think a lot of this is people are seeing that, at least in rhetoric, maybe at first, the U.S. is trying to reassert itself in some ways. And so people have a lot more confidence in the economy and they're putting money back into it.
Related to that and the military, President Trump tweeted here just, I guess it was a day or so ago, talking about China in relation to North Korea. He said, "They do nothing," all caps, "for us with North Korea. Just talk. We will no longer allow this to continue. China could easily solve this problem," that being North Korea, which I think he's right. And then a Chinese official, Victor Gaog, said that the U.S. was acting like a spoiled child because we don't want to be nuked by North Korea. That's spoiled behavior. I don't quite get the correlation there.
Well, at least that Chinese official spoke his mind, but it would also be nice to hear him be honest and say, "Well, yeah, we could stop it, but we don't share any of the same interests or values as you, and we hope that North Korea antagonizes you in every way." He was honest with his thoughts about the president, but not about his own country.
Some of the comments to that story were pretty interesting. This one person said, "Right, because North Korea, that leadership is the competent adult in the situation." The U.S. being the spoiled child.
Also a good point there.
Somebody else wants to ban purchasing things from China. Of course, they make everything, so that would be interesting. But the person said, "I think I can survive without a $20 toaster that breaks in 2 months and a shirt that fades after 5 washes. So that was their opinion on the China situation.
Yeah, it is funny because in the area of diplomacy, people say things and everyone knows they're lying, but you can't call them out because we need to be civil. But everyone knows that China is lying through their teeth. And in fact, the last few ICBM launches from North Korea have been fired from a Chinese missile platform. So they wouldn't even be able to fire it without China giving them a vehicle in which to do it. So China knows a lot about North Korea's program. And they're, to me, well, I think it's dangerous too to say, "Oh, well, China should solve it," because China could just invade all of Korea. And then now all of a sudden we have China conquering a ally in South Korea and being right beside Japan. That would be a huge disaster as well. But they could very well do that, easily do it. And I don't know, especially with half the U.S. in range of North Korea's nukes now, President Trump is going to have to do something, and the U.S., and they're going to end up offending China and everyone else. But it's just weighing the risks, I guess.
Well, South Korea came out, right, and they said they want nukes. They want their own. And over the weekend, China and Russia had their big military parades and flexed their muscles. And so, you know, they're definitely on the move. They're not backing down. They obviously want to conquest or conquer the globe, and that's their mentality. So the U.S. is in a situation, well, what do you do? Do you fight back? Where do you draw the line? And then you got Europe over there just sitting low, looking around. but people, you know, the people that are really paying attention to the reality of things, not this, you know, global or warming climate change nonsense, the reality on the ground of militaries fighting other militaries, they've got to be planning what they're going to do, because Russia and China certainly aren't just sitting there doing nothing. They're amping things up all the time.
And the reality is, when we look around the entire world, you don't see too many nations that think fondly of America anymore. We're just going to have to deal with the fact that these countries are going to be upset no matter what this country does, because they hate the country in general. It's not a matter of appeasing those different countries. It's a matter of doing what's best for this country.
Yeah, you can't ever get along with North Korea. You can't make a deal. I mean, I guess we sort of tried that, right, in the Clinton era. Didn't work, obviously. You can't make a deal with China because they always try to come out on top, and they don't want peace necessarily. They want to rule. Not that they necessarily want war, but they want to rule through whatever means necessary. I'm going to take a stab in the dark here and say Vladimir Putin wants to be in charge of the world. so apparently, you know, they have some high aspirations there, and who's going to stop them? That's the question.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because we're in this conundrum, but the solution to it all is by using force and is by not being afraid of offending China or Russia. And in fact, a show of force is the only thing that will stop them. Because Stalin is the one who instigated the Korean War in the first place that set up this whole situation. And the reason he backed off from Truman is that Truman did send the army in under MacArthur to fight back. And even with such a limited response as was done in the Korean War in the 50s, Stalin backed off and he realized that if we attack anywhere else, like in Eastern Europe, they're going to fight us. They're not going to be, it's not going to be a cakewalk. And so that same kind of response needs to be done today, where we have Russia and China obviously trying to expand their power, even so far as Putin invading Georgia, Ukraine, these other smaller nations. And it's only by using a show of force that they'll respect us and they'll realize, like, hey, we need to stop this or else we are going to fight with the United States. And so that's really the only option on the table to fix this, but it's probably the last one that we'll ever take.
Yeah, we're so divided here in the U.S. And I'm sure all these other nations see that, and they are playing on it, you know, where they can attack the leader, President Trump, and know that they've got the media on their side, and they've got, I don't know, some percentage of the U.S. population on their side as well. So we're fighting ourselves at the same time. But also tying into the wanting to use force, this is from AFP. Mass rally in Istanbul over Israel's Jerusalem measures. Thousands of supporters of a conservative Turkish party rallied in... Is there a liberal Turkish party that I'm unaware of? You know, there's all these political parties there. Of course there are. A conservative Turkish party rallied in Istanbul on Sunday to protest measures taken by Israel and Jerusalem and show solidarity with the Palestinians. This is in relation to Israel wanting to put in... putting in metal detectors on the Temple Mount, but then they removed them. But they're still protesting. The move sparked Muslims, metal detectors, sparked Muslim protests and deadly unrest. And last week, the Israeli government removed the detectors and cameras. And the cameras, huh? But feelings remain high in Turkey, they say, with President Recep Tayyip Erdogan saying the removal of the detectors was not enough. So that leads to the question, well, what would be enough? And I think it's answered by this next line here where it says that the protests under the slogan of Israel understands a show of strength, the rally was held at this place over there in Turkey. So I think that's the answer to the question. You know, it's not enough for them to remove their metal detectors, but a show of strength against them. Now, that's something they want to do, which would be violence and war, right?
A lot of those nations over there seem to be rallying around the Palestinian cause. I saw a headline even... where I believe it was the Jordanian king saying that he believes that Jordan should protect Israel or the Palestinians from the Judaization of these holy sites in Israel. So even holy sites within their own nation can't be controlled by them. It's the Jordanians have to intervene or some of these other nations have to intervene. They would not take too kindly to maybe the Jews going into their countries and trying to protect those holy sites from maybe the Islamification of those sites.
Well, and the hypocrisy of calling those places holy sites is that what would they do with control of them? They just use them to run terror attacks right out of them.
Yeah.
So, that, I mean, they're in their holy. Mind, that's one and the same. They think they're fighting a holy war. So they're not like they're just going to sit there and have their prayer services. They're going to arm up. They already have. And that's what they're trying to stop. The Israelis are trying to stop.
Yeah, well, that's why this was all started. Is they attacked Israeli security guards. And it's funny because Jordan is a nation that has control of the Temple Mount. They're the ones who supply the forces that are supposed to be protecting it. And so it's a problem for Israel because even when I was there, I couldn't go on the Temple Mount. They do allow visitors on there, but I couldn't go on because we had a Jewish... one of our coworkers was showing us around because she was Jewish. She wasn't allowed up there. So we weren't allowed to go on the Temple Mount because of that. And so there's already a lot of tension there and just ridiculous. And the big loser are the Palestinians because they're just so obviously being used as a tool of these other Arab countries to attack Israel. And they're just being used as cannon fodder. Turkey, Jordan, all these other countries would never take Israel head on because they'd lose. But they're willing to sacrifice the Palestinians just to make the Jews look bad and to weaken them. And so, I mean, despite everything we say about the Palestinians being victims by Israel, they're actually victims of their own people, of all these other Arab countries just using them.
Yeah. It's always interesting when they have these protests in like Turkey, and if you read the article, they say, well, there weren't any government officials there, and this was kind of a, you know, spontaneous sort of thing. Oh, come on. Of course it's not. The government's completely behind it. They're not just ran. It's like in Iran when they protest, you know, Israel. Those countries don't operate like that. You don't just get up one day and say, hey, everyone follow me down to the square, you know, and we'll make signs. It's clearly sponsored by the government, but they make it out like, I don't know, there's a few people just protesting.
Well, Erdogan is one of the most outspoken anti-Semitic leaders in the entire world. So even if it weren't sponsored by the government, he still would support a movement like that.
I'm glad that I am not in a position where I'd have to have a meeting with him, because I would be so tempted to make the joke and say, all right, let's get down to talking turkey. then you'd lose all negotiation ability right there. But I think it's funny. I have a riddle for you guys. This is a riddle that I think I've made up, and you guys can use it or not. What is the fastest way to eat 1,000 cows?
McDonald's.
yeah, that's true. Or just buy beef from the store. This Huffington Post reports that Sutter Meats butcher Terry Regazza confirmed supermarkets are guilty of this same habit that fast food restaurants are. Supermarkets are getting their meat from large distributors where 1 pound of ground beef can contain meat from up to 1,000 different animals. So if you're buying stuff from the store, you're probably getting who knows what in that pound.
Well, hopefully they're all cows.
Hopefully.
They don't accidentally throw one pig in there among the hundreds of other cows.
They say this practice makes it impossible to trace the meat source. Without traceability, foodborne illness outbreaks cannot be contained. Not every supermarket does it. You'd have to kind of look, I guess. But they say the best way to guarantee the freshness of your ground beef is to go to a butcher who grinds their meat daily. So anyway, that is sort of a concern, I guess, if you do have 1 pound of beef and it's coming from thousands of different animals. And you know, I mean, it happens sometimes where there's a foodborne illness that breaks out. How do you trace it? Where did it come from? What are you eating? Yeah. It's a little unnerving to think about that.
Well, it's just foolishness, in my opinion. The grocers just maybe saving a little bit of money, but being completely irresponsible, because what if people die because of the illness? They can't stop it. Part of the blame is their fault, and just they're just not protecting themselves or the people who are buying it. And I'm just glad that some of the beef I've gotten lately is from my father-in-law, because he raises cows and we're able to buy some or get some meat from him that's no antibiotics, and we know it's from one cow. And not from a bunch of other ones. And so, I'm not surprised that there are many, many other malpractices out there with meat that would make us sick if we knew about everything they did.
Yeah, there was that kid who works at a McDonald's. He was made the news last week. He tweeted out a picture of the inside of the ice cream machine. It had mold all in it. People were not happy with that at all. The McDonald's people weren't happy with it. Because, I mean, obviously, you know, it would gross people out. But, hey, it happens. and it's funny, too, just how social media today, you know, years ago, you'd tell your buddy, hey, look at this, and that's as far as it would go. But now you tweet out a picture, and the whole world knows about the whatever's happening in that particular store.
Yeah, it does help hold certain things more accountable in a way. That is one good thing about it. But most of the time, it's not used for that purpose. It's used for the exact opposite. So,
right. Yep. Speaking of food and eating things and too many things, they had a taco eating contest. That you know that you all everybody's heard of the hot dog eating contest. Well, they did with tacos or some sort of taco food, I guess. And the guy that won it is the same guy that won the hot dog eating contest. So I guess he can eat a lot of anything. Joey Chestnut. If anyone's heard of him.
That guy's incredible.
He can eat a lot. They say the final results from the speed eating contest at Taco Throwdown 7. This is the 7th annual, apparently. With name, city of residence, and total tacos consumed, Joey Chestnut won from San Jose, California, 892. In 8 minutes, I believe.
Wow.
92. So, wow. it's unbelievable that they could eat that much. He won $4,000. So, I don't know. What happens to these people, like, in the aftermath? Like, they must feel horrible. They must be sick the next couple of days.
Well, they probably just get rid of all the food in a probably pretty grotesque way because, I mean, you just can't take that many calories or, like, it's just overwhelming for the body. So, yeah, just strength. It's the most disgusting sport, quote unquote. I just can't watch it. I can watch a lot of other sports that people might not handle, but that I just can't.
Yeah.
Especially the hot dog one, just food's going everywhere, and there's, like, women there, too, trying to go down, and, like, some of them throw up, and it's just...
It's a horrible thing.
Yeah.
Actually, the person that came in fifth place was a lady, Michelle Lesko from Tucson, Arizona. She had 46 tacos.
Wow.
Taco Tuesday. And then Mary Bauer, she came in 10th. She only had 20. So, wow. she 20, and then here comes Joey Chestnut. Oh, I ate 92. She's got some work to do.
How big are those tacos? Especially eating, like, hard food?
I don't know. I don't know all the details of what they were throwing down there, but, yeah, Taco Throwdown 7. Hopefully the final one, but who knows?
Yeah, because hot dogs, I understand, because it's all soft.
Yeah.
But with, like, the hard chips, like, if you don't chew those well and you swallow, you, like, scratch your...
I'm not sure exactly what they were eating here, whether it was, like, a softer thing or whatever, but... So, apparently, if you can eat a lot of one thing, you can eat a lot of another thing. I think that's the lesson. He can eat a lot of hot dogs. He can eat a lot of tacos.
Those competitions are pretty much enthralling to watch because there's really no shame among any of the competitors. They'll have the food all over their face. They don't even take the time to wipe it off because there isn't time. They're in a race.
How do you judge that? Like, somebody has to sit there and watch and make sure that they actually ate it. You can do the Cookie Monster thing. You remember where he's a puppet, obviously. So he just smashed it all up and threw it around. When I was a kid, I paid attention to that. I'm like, he's not eating the cookies. They're just breaking apart.
Someone would probably have to pay attention to that because I'm sure there's some sort of trick where you could act like you ate it and then make a big enough mess to where you hardly consumed any of it at all.
Go back to the instant replay.
Yeah.
Slow-mo. Thankfully, it was a blowout, 92 to 83 second place. But if it was 92-91, you'd have to go back and take a look and really, really see what happened there.
Yeah, that's. I might be able to compete in like a Doritos eating contest, but maybe that's about it. But yeah, I just imagine if they're the competitors preparing for, if they watch the film of the other people, they just watch hours and hours of their competitors eating food, and they're like, I like that guy's technique.
How do you train?
Yeah.
How do you train for that? They should try to combine the food eating contest with American Ninja Warrior.
Yeah.
In every part of it, there's food hanging that you have to eat and complete the course. Might as well. Why not? The only thing, I wonder if they have a sleeping contest, like how long can you stay asleep? And how would you judge that? You have fakers. You get a lot of fakers.
Well,
you're not really sleeping there.
Isn't that, they already do that in high school, don't they?
It's called study hall?
Yeah.
Yeah. I still always remember the kid that fell asleep in study hall in high school, and lunch was the next period in the same cafeteria area. So he fell asleep in study hall. He slept through half of the lunch. And then he woke up, and of course, his surroundings had completely changed because he went to sleep in the quiet study hall, and he wakes up with everyone around him eating. And I remember watching him wake up, and he had fallen asleep on the spiral of his notebook.
Oh.
And he just kind of shot up and looked around, startled. And then he just, like, grabbed his notebook and huffed out of there. But he had the spiral mark down the side of his face. That was a bad day at Merrill Senior High.
Yeah, well, it's funny. When you knock on someone's door, you're picking them up. You can tell if they're sleeping because they have the marks or the red spots on their face. And like, oh, yeah, I was just getting ready. I'm like, were you or are you sleeping?
That happens if somebody calls me and I've been sleeping. And I think in my mind that, no, I sound convincing, but I think they always know. I'm like, oh, yeah, hello. And they're like, oh, I didn't wake you, did I? And I'm like, no, of course. And of course, yeah.
Well, for me, it's the opposite. When I wake up, I'm fine. But when I've been awake for hours, and especially when my dad calls me, he's like, Abraham, did I wake you up? I'm like, no, I've been awake all day. And I'm like, do I really sound like that groggy normally?
Yeah, maybe so. That's why we do the show early in the morning. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. Key of David program's coming up. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Joel Hilliker today from Edstone, England, filling in for Stephen Fleury. Also, stop and check out thetrumpet.com. Our radical leftist millennials really snowflakes. Not literally, but yeah, you know what the term means. That's by Jeremiah Jacques. It's an interesting write-up there. And also now, The Age of Expression Suppression by Dennis Leap, who has a new episode of Just the Best Literature today, by the way, as well, here on KPCG. Grant, you have a write-up from The Federalist. Now, before you know, people get upset, this is written by a lady. Okay, how acting like a feminist can ruin your marriage. And a woman wrote this up, so what does she have to say?
And to go even further, she is happily married with four children, and she stays at home and teaches all of them from home, and it seems to be working out pretty well for her. So she can speak from experience about how this works. She is talking about how obviously a lot of blame has gone onto the men in terms of people struggling to get married in the first place or having a tough time once the marriage gets underway. Articles like childish men are to blame for women having kids late in life. People talking about a dearth of marriageable men has left an oversupply of educated women taking desperate steps to preserve their fertility in terms of like even freezing their eggs for later when, once they finally find a man who is perfect. Apparently that's what right. they're looking for.
Well, and I think she, one of the things she points out in the article is there is that thinking, but the stats show that 70% of divorces are the woman is the one that goes and tries to get it.
Exactly.
And now, of course, there'd be that side that says, well, they're probably in a, you know, being oppressed and all this. That could happen in some cases, but those are pretty big numbers. And a lot of it does get back to this sort of feminist thinking, which is very hostile against man. It's hard to be hostile against something and then have a partnership. You know what I mean? Like, right. like how would that work in any other situation in life? Like, I hate such and such, but yeah, we'll make it work. you can't.
You marry a person of the group that you hate.
Right.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And yet, women who are feminists still think that somehow a marriage for them could work. I'm sure a lot of them don't think they even need a man in their lives at all. But of those who do, it's hard to understand why they think that because their entire ideology is anti-man. You can't coexist in one house right. with a man when you can't stand them. Apparently that's what they're trying to do, and it just isn't working. And this author just says, well, maybe females have become less marriageable. Probably a statement that could spark a lot of fury today. But whenever women are told to be bold and assertive, whenever they're hit with all these taglines like just be one of the boys, or maybe fight like a girl, or strong as the new pretty, or find your fierce. Mm-hmm. All of these different taglines that may seem nice if you're single and independent, but try to translate those types of qualities over into a marriage, and a lot of men aren't going to like that.
Well, like she points out, I mean, there are times for a young lady to be strong and all those things, and that's all fine and good, but if you're being combative against males, at some point, that's going to cause friction. It's going to cause problems. If your whole attitude is, and again, she's it's like this weird teeter-totter on between, on one hand, they're going to be the aggressors, and then as she points out, but as soon as something doesn't work out, then they're the victims. You can't live a life like that because you're either going to be mad or you're going to be mad because you're the victim. I mean, it's not a formula for peace and harmony and teamwork on any level.
That is a huge aspect of feminism as well, where they try to cherry pick the best parts of both sides. So whenever it comes to maybe a more masculine trait, they would want to go be the breadwinner in the home. But at the same time, if they go out on a date, they don't want to pay for it. So they still want the man to pay for them on the date. There's a lot of things like that where it's kind of hard for any man to reconcile those things and to figure out what a woman's actually expecting in different situations. And if you just see the way that a lot of women have changed just because of a societal push away from femininity, this author says it is reflected in our sarcasm, sexual habits, attire, and goals. And a recent study even showed that women are cursing more than men. Those things are not really very attractive. And it's just pretty simple that maybe that's why a lot of those marriages aren't going well.
Yeah, and it really is a just trying to flip the genders around, which now we actually see happening, to where that that, I mean, I think that's probably the end goal of the, you know, what they're trying to do with some of these different movements here. And it's happening, you know, and there's no way, again, you could look at any sector of society. There's no way you could successfully work at a company that you hate and are trying to undermine for long. There's no way you could play in a sports team where you hate everybody on the team and you're trying to sabotage them. Kevin Durant, and there's no, and, no, just kidding. But
true.
But you know, there's, you look at any part of life, and if you're not willing to get along, to work together, to use each other's strengths to help somebody with a weakness, and be a team and a partnership, it's not going to succeed. How would it succeed in the most intimate type of relationship, a marriage?
Well, that's too much logic and common sense for a lot of people to handle. It's so obvious, and yet, I mean, I even saw a commercial recently about some sort of online degree course, and it's got these animated people in the commercial. There's the first scene is a woman who is looking after her children at home, and they're playing happily, but she's just sort of staring off into the distance because, you know, she's being held down in the home. And then eventually she's getting her degree, and of course her children are celebrating with her, but then she's sitting at her desk in the office and the children are nowhere to be found anymore. And the commercial, of course, does not cover where those children have to go while the mom leaves the home. And so you just see commercials like that all the time where it's just a huge push to upend what we have typically seen in families that have worked so well for centuries.
Well, and like she points out in this article too, again, Carrie Gress writes it, and she says, well, obviously, if the woman in the marriage is hostile to the man, and she's really being pretty mean to him, what does he do? Well, he goes away. He becomes, whether he actually physically leaves or he just kind of goes into his own world, he kind of fits back into that stereotype that's always pushed of the, he just watches sports and he never talks to me, you know, that type of thing. But he's being pushed in that direction. But they have found, surprise, surprise, that if the woman's actually nice to the husband, actually tries to help him and be an encouragement to him, lo and behold, he likes that. Right. And I mean, come on, just even friendships. If somebody's mean to you all the time, you're not going to want to hang out with them. If they're nice to you, you probably will. It's not that big of a deal.
And yet feminism pushes these women to do the exact opposite, where they have to be strong and dominant in the relationship, and they have to basically be in charge of what happens in that relationship. So they have to, if the husband is not doing what they want, the woman has to correct him and just get stronger and stronger with the correction until finally he gives in. And apparently that's just not working. That's why we're seeing men withdraw in a lot of situations. And so a lot of these criticisms of men could actually be inflicted by the women, where you're saying, well, you don't ever do any of the work around the house and you're not helping me at all with the kids. And so sure enough, he does less of the things that she wants him to do because he's just being beat over the head all the time. That just doesn't work. It doesn't make any sense why these women think it would work, unless maybe there's a deeper agenda of undermining family as it is.
Right. But the results are nobody's happy. It doesn't make the women in those situations happy. It doesn't make the men happy. It doesn't make the kids happy. And so when you look at the numbers, and we talked about it last week, the reports are that people are getting married later in life or not getting married at all. If you grew up in a bad situation and you saw that, I can understand from that perspective why people would be hesitant to get into something where they're just going to be beat over the head all the time. It's going to end in an argument and ultimately a divorce. Why get into that?
True. And also, if you think about feminists, where they're getting their ideas from is from other women. And so they're not even considering the man's perspective, what he might find attractive, which it's pretty obvious what it is. I mean, you'll hear it in every love song, in every nice bit of poetry you'll read it. It's a woman who is loyal, sweet, calm, kind, thoughtful. It's not about, like, she runs the house and tells me what to do and is always correcting me. Being a prickly woman is not going to convince the man to go over and give her a hug.
Yeah, it would be you typically don't want to marry one of your buddies. You know what I mean? That pushes you around all the time.
Yeah, fellow tough guy.
Yeah, right. You're like, nah. Because what happens, even between guys, is if, you know, you got guys that are, all, everybody's trying to be the alpha dog, well, you're going to have a lot of conflict there, whether it's on the sports field or wherever else. You can't live that way in a house where everyone's trying to be the top dog. It just is not going to work.
Right. Well, it just reminds me of something read recently, and just about Churchill, because his mother, in Victorian England, women's supposed to be humble and submit to their husbands, that sort of thing. But his mother was the exact opposite of that. And at the time, she was seen as like one of the great stars of Victorian England, all this stuff. But if you look in history, in hindsight, it has flipped. She's seen as a woman who completely dismissed her children. Her son, it's a miracle Churchill got out of his childhood with anything, because she did help him out a little bit, but she was more worried about having affairs and social parties and all these things than her own children. And she may have been a successful woman out of the house, but the only reason her son survived and was able to do all the great things he did was because of there was a woman in his life, Elizabeth Everest, who was his mother, basically right. His nanny, and who nurtured him. And so there is a role that women play, and a very powerful one that thankfully Mrs. Everest did play one, so Churchill could save Western civilization. But in hindsight, his mother is seen almost as a villain because of she's made a lot of terrible mistakes in her life. And so for feminism, in the moment, it might seem like a good idea. But when with the benefit of hindsight, we do see history show that it doesn't work out and it causes a lot of problems.
Yeah, and it's hard to even imagine a feminist saying that the Churchill marriage was a successful one. Her husband died of a sexually transmitted disease, and since she was having affairs all the time, committing adultery, who knows if maybe she gave it to him and even got her own husband killed. That type of relationship where the woman is not loyal and she is not doing her role, she's neglecting the kid, not visiting him except for once in 10 years while he's at a boarding school, that just doesn't work. That's just a terrible way to bring up children, a terrible example to set for the children when that's the way you're treating your husband. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, and, you know, it's really interesting, too, the feminist ideology. It's a very selfish ideology. So if you look at it in a vacuum, say one person looks at it and they say, well, I want to be the top. I want to be the whatever, the number one. Maybe that seems okay, but what about everybody else? Because everybody else that subscribes to that ideology, they also want to be the top. Not everybody can be number one. But I wonder about, say a woman who has a son and he's going to get married. Who does she want him to marry? Does she want him to marry a raging feminist? I would guess not. But that's interesting. If you follow the track of this type of thinking down several generations, do people that personally say, yes, I like this feminist ideology, do they want that coming into their family from some other group where they're coming in with those ideas? I would think not, but that would be interesting to look at.
That is a great point. And I actually heard a quote recently, like, what's the desire to be number one if there aren't any other numbers? If you're number one and you're just completely isolated and alone, and that's what a lot of feminists are going to end up as, what is the use in that? You're number one, but there's no one else. It's not like you're ahead of a bunch of people. You're just number one because there's only one person.
It's a recipe for loneliness, that's for sure. And and a lot of anger. You don't see a lot of happy feminists or whatever people are protesting. That just happens to be what we're talking about right now. But you don't see a lot of joy there. You know, like, this is great. Everything's going really well. It's always anger, the struggle, the victim, whatever it might be.
You have to get more out of the relationship.
Nothing's enough. Everyone's wronged me. Yeah, there's a being that's like that. If people look at the Bible, thinks that way. So you have to wonder where some of those ideas come from, because there's nothing positive. There's nothing giving about it. It's all about taking.
Yeah, well, I think for both men and women, if one side is selfish, everyone suffers, especially the children. But if you look at abortion or other rights or other empowerment we've given the women or men, it doesn't matter which side you look at it. But with abortion, it's very selfish, where a child's life is gone because the mother doesn't want the child. Men do the same thing. They might value something or leave a family because they want something when they shouldn't and abandon their family. You see on both sides of the fence. But it just comes down to selfishness. And the children are the big losers of it, in the sense that they grew up in a broken home, and usually there's a lot of scars and unhappiness. And then when they grow up, it can tend to perpetuate for generations rather than a child having a better future than you. Just like the Bible says, a good man leaves inheritance for his son's sons. That's not just wealth, but that's memories. Just good things you can pass on to your children.
So perhaps for those who prefer to be selfish, don't commit to marriage and family when those things are the ultimate unselfish proven grounds. You have to constantly be sacrificing for other people in a family, and yet it brings more joy than anything else. If people don't want to do that, then don't get into it in the first place.
That's a really good point. I mean, you have to look at anything you want to join, whether it be a marriage or anything, and say, what does it take to make that work? And if you don't want to do that, then don't do it. Because you can't, no marriage has ever worked selfishly. Ever. I mean, that it just doesn't work. It's the same. We see it in everything. We see it in sports. Oh, you can't play with that guy. Guy gets a rep. You just can't play with him. Selfish guy. Same in anything. So it's really interesting write-ups from The Federalist, How Acting Like a Feminist Can Ruin Your Marriage by Carrie Gress. Hey, send her your negative comments. We're just saying what she said.
That's right.
But anyway, you can send us comments to comments at kpcg.fm. That's we're fine with that. Abraham, you got a couple stories, but we got time for just one. We'll hit the history note. It's the 100th anniversary of the Battle of Passchendaele, and you want to look at the important lessons on how war affects the civilian population.
Yeah, this commemorations are taking place in Belgium and in Britain. Prince of Wales gave a speech today commemorating the British troops who fought there. And basically, Battle of Passchendaele, or it's also called the Third Battle of Ypres, was fought between July 31st and November 6th, 1917. And it's one of the major British offensives that was very mediocre. They gained about 7 miles. There were about 250,000 casualties from both sides, German and British combined. They gained 7 miles, and then less than a year later, they retreated back when the Germans attacked. So the whole offensive meant nothing in the end of the war. And so it's a big, there's a lot of symbolism there of World War I, the trenches, the warfare, the how there was nothing productive being done there on the battlefront. And so there were Canadians, New Zealanders, Australians, French, British, they all fought at this battle. And so I think it's interesting to look back on, because a lot of people look at it as kind of the pointlessness of war, everything that was wrong with World War I, and that's true. But if we look at it the other way, this is one of the battles that has really a big collective memory in most populations, especially Canada, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, those who fought in it. Every nation has battles like this, where they lose a lot of men, and it leaves the nation shocked so much that when a war comes up later, they remember the sacrifices and are very unwilling to go back to war, because they don't want to lose their fathers and their sons and their brothers, all these things. And so I think it's interesting to look back, especially in the world today where we have North Korea, we have Iran, we have all these big threats that do take some sacrifice from the civilian population, because people will die, trade might be affected, prices might go up, all these different effects from war. But at this time, during World War I, the nation was willing to sacrifice. America including, too, they were in the war at this point. And these nations were willing to sacrifice no matter what it took to defeat an enemy they knew that was a threat to them. But we've seen how war weariness and the shock of battle can wear down a nation to where they become pacifist and complacent, and it never works out well. Because what was the next war just 30 years later? It was World War II, and Britain barely went to war there. They with all the history of the pacifism of Neville Chamberlain and such. And so we see the same cycle repeating today with American superpower, where we have maybe our own Battle of Passchendaele in Iraq or Vietnam or wherever it might be. And America is unwilling to sacrifice again to defeat some very serious threats. I mean, we're talking about a nuclear attack on America from North Korea, but yet people are more concerned about the healthcare vote than national security. And so we're seeing the same cycle, the same way of thinking, that this battle of Passchendaele inspired a generation before us. And just a pretty disturbing trend of human nature, I guess, that we're seeing play out in America today.
Yeah, I think there's probably some wisdom in not reporting on all the details of some battles. You know, and that's really the difference that we saw, especially with Vietnam going forward, where they show you the horrors of war. It comes into your living room and you know about them. And it does destroy the morale of the people to go and fight for something. Now, obviously, it would be great if there were no wars, but that's not the reality. After the U.S. dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, in the aftermath of that, MacArthur wouldn't allow anyone to even talk about really what had happened or what the effects were, because they just didn't want that getting out for a lot of reasons. But when I was thinking about that in terms of different battles. When people can see what's all happened, it just destroys their willingness to fight because they're afraid.
It just shows how important the media is, and also just the way history is recorded. If the focus is all on, oh, this is a Western imperialist oppressor going into someone else's backyard and causing trauma, well, then a lot of people aren't going to support that. But if the heroic deeds are highlighted, if the people who are reporting on those actions actually understand who are the good guys and who are the bad guys, which it doesn't seem like they understand, then a lot of people will be a lot more supportive because the reporting will be more positive on those situations.
Even the case there in Japan after World War II, I mean, there was different feelings about it, but a lot of people actually blame their own government. And they said, well, we're the ones that were the aggressors,
right?
And we got what came to us, and they understood that. And so there was different thinking back then. But, you know, if you look at propaganda films from World War II, it's very positive towards the U.S., the ones they would show here, of course, before movies and things. And, you know, it seems like, I hate to say fun, but, I mean, oh, you watch it and it's like heroic and everyone's moving. It looks great. They didn't show you the real difficulties. But if you're going to try to get people to support the cause, you can't show them all the hardships because it's going to cause fear and people are going to pull back. So I think there is some wisdom in maybe not revealing all of that. But
yeah, that's a great point. And actually during Vietnam, the U.S. Army had a term called the John Wayne complex. And that is, people would watch John Wayne movies, become patriotic, and join the army without understanding what warfare is actually like.
Yeah.
And now that's not necessarily a bad thing. We do need to educate ourselves, but there's nothing wrong with being patriotic. And it's a tough learning curve, though, say the least, learning how warfare actually is. But at the same time, I think, especially with modern media, especially the war in Iraq and the Gulf War and all that, the way it was covered, when you focus on loss and you make soldiers look like victims, that's completely the wrong way to look at it. The soldiers don't think of themselves as victims at all. And in fact, I think it's insulting to think that our soldiers are victims. When they're willing to put their lives on the line for us, it's a noble sacrifice. It's not something to necessarily bemoan, even though it is tragic that people have to die. But there is a cost to war, and that's an unfortunate thing. But we wouldn't be living if it wasn't for people willing to die for their country. And so I think another side to this that World War One really points out is that, why do lots of men die in war? Why do we have wars where, in this case, almost 100,000 men died, 250,000 were casualties? Why does a battle like that happen? Is it because, do we blame the machine guns, the weather, the trenches? Or should we look at ourselves and say, why did such a cataclysm come to our nation at this time? Because wars, you can look at them maybe as time and chance, but there could be a bigger purpose behind them, especially with the British Empire, the arrogance, the opulence. A lot of things were going on there that weren't good, and World War One was a big shock to the system that maybe your society isn't going in the right direction. And this is a terrible warning of what happens if you keep going down that path. And so there is that side of it, too, where everyone in the whole nation, including the civilian population, have a huge effect on the military and how many men die, because sometimes wars go poorly because the whole nation as a whole is laying down in morality or that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah. You can't go out and be a very good soldier if you... Well, you can't do anything very well if your morality is corrupt. There's really no examples of that in history where people can be extremely immoral and yet have great success. Not for long. Typically, the cycle is there was some righteousness, and because of that, there were blessings, and then those blessings people took for granted and end up became decadent, and then they become immoral, and then it all falls apart. So, I mean, that cycle's happened multiple times.
Yeah, well, especially with the English-speaking peoples. A lot of the times we see these immoral societies. I just read a lot about Nazi Germany yesterday and the experiments and the science and how they try to change the Bible to make the... and all these terrible things they did. And their soldiers fought very well, but it's because they had no humanity.
Right.
They were brutal. And the English-speaking nation is the opposite. When we're immoral or we have all these corruptions, we become soft. We don't become even more hard like the Gentiles do with... or these other nations where they are... they become more brutal, and that's kind of their culture. We become more and more soft until we just fall apart. And so we kind of have the opposite effect that immorality has on our culture. And so that, and that's what we're seeing in this battle of passion. It was a terrible sacrifice, but it is good to look back on young men and old men who are willing to fight for their country and put a lot of things above themselves. And we just don't see that anymore. And so it's good to remember these things and try to learn the lessons from them.
100th anniversary of the Battle of Passchendaele today, right?
Yes,
yeah,
today.
Today is the 100th anniversary of that. So that's all the time we have here on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. A little bit of a cooler one here in Edmond, Oklahoma. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show, coming your way. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turge, and Abraham Blondeau, enjoy the rest of your Monday. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.